The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, first I want to thank you all for being here and practicing this way. I take it as a wonderful thing and feel that it's a fortunate thing to spend a day with people who are practicing so well. Gathering together and sitting this way, and you know, it's kind of in a general sense, perhaps, if you gather 50 people together to spend a day together in a small room like this, it's maybe not the most obvious circumstances for harmony. But, you know, there's pretty harmonious, maybe because we don't speak to each other. But it's quite something to have the shared devotion to the practice, engagement with it. I think of the practice as being a kind of a commitment to truth, showing up for what really is here, and have the shared commitment to at least to try to do that, keep showing up for this, to be true to this, is a really exceptional thing to find in this world. And I think it's wonderful that we've spent this day together this way. So thank you. And what's on my mind is to talk about the mind. So we'll see how that goes. This English word mind is pretty ambiguous what it actually refers to, as far as I can tell. Probably the word consciousness is easier to figure out what it is, but no one's figured that out either. But mind maybe is an abstraction. It's a kind of a general idea about something. But to actually pinpoint exactly what it is probably doesn't work, because maybe the mind isn't a particular thing. Maybe it's the gestalt. Maybe it's the kind of the impression we have, the idea we have of the whole, of all the different mental functionings we have and mental operations, and at least whatever we can kind of be aware of and to know. And in the ancient Buddhist language, there's a word for mind, and that is citta, C-I-T-T-A. And that's probably just as vague, that it's not a specific singular entity or thing that we can say, okay, this is what it is. It's a kind of the same thing. It's a kind of an impression or an idea or a perception or a general sense of something. But even though it's a general sense, that we can't really specify exactly what it is, it's still a very important reference point. People use it a lot. I just use it. It's on my mind, I said, and to give this talk. And in the teachings of the Buddha, he uses word citta for mind quite a bit. And one of the probably singular, most significant or powerful for me kind of places where he uses it that kind of gets at least my attention, that this is an important thing, is he uses it to talk about, more often than not, when he talks about liberation, spiritual liberation, awakening, he doesn't say it's a person who's liberated. He does that sometimes, it's not ruled out. But the most common way he talks about liberation is that it's not the person who's liberated, but it's the mind that's liberated. And a very common expression is the mind was liberated through non-clinging. When the mind doesn't cling to anything, it becomes free. It's the mind that becomes free. What about you? Do you get left behind? Do you not count? It's all about your mind. And what is this? So what is this mind that we have? And how do we know it, or how do we recognize it? One of the very strong teachings that the Buddha has around mind is that the mind can be developed, it can be cultivated, it can be changed, it can be trained, it can be tamed, it can be mastered. It's not a fixed thing, it's not something which is unchangeable, some true essence which will always be there, the true mind or something. Whatever it is, it's something that can be trained. developed. And when it becomes developed, he refers to the mind sometimes as being luminous. Sometimes he uses the word bright, illuminated. Sometimes he uses a word like clean. The mind becomes clean or purified. Or the mind becomes malleable or workable, ready. Imagine that your mind is ready. Ready for what? Just a state of readiness for whatever comes. Maybe ready for liberation. And all these kind of descriptions of it, that it's pure, clean, luminous, bright, clear. Another words that's sometimes described is that the mind becomes expansive or large, big mind. In Zen, they talk about big mind. But the same word is there in the teachings of the Buddha. We just don't call it big mind. We usually translate it as expansive mind. Maha citta. And a concentrated mind. The mind can get concentrated. And another place where you see this word mind, citta, that put a tremendous emphasis in the Buddha's teachings in terms of development, is that when the Buddha taught mindfulness practice, part of the instructions for the four foundations of mindfulness, there's a whole foundation called mindfulness of the mind, of citta. In the Anapanasati sequence of mindfulness practice, there's a whole section about experiencing the mind. And then there's concentrating the mind and settling the mind. That's part of it. So as a category, the word mind is very important, citta. But what is it? What in the world is it? How do we know it when we see it? Do you know what your mind is? Maybe you know it, but you can't explain what it is. Maybe you know it when you see it. Maybe you know it when it wanders off and you bring it back. Maybe you know it when it's, contracted or on fire with anger or shame or something. Oh, the mind is really hot or contracted or shriveled up. You ever had a mind that felt like a raisin? Dried out? So how do we know the mind? And what is it? So in thinking about this, the idea of the mind becomes liberated. What is a liberated mind like? How is that experienced? What's that feel like? What happens? How do we know? How do we look into the mind and see the mind as being liberated? If two people are holding onto each other really tightly with their hands, maybe they're really codependent and clinging and they're not going to let go. No way they're going to let go of each other. They're there. They hate each other. But they're completely not going to give up, and they're holding on for dear life, holding on tight. And then someone comes along, a well-meaning person, and says, by the way, it's not really required to have his life grip on each other's hands. You could, even just for a minute, release it. Liberate your hands from that grip. So they think that's a good idea, so they do it. And so their hands now are liberated from each other. The hands are liberated. Maybe they're not, because they're just as much tied up in each other, but their hands are liberated. What is the evidence of that liberation? One of the evidences is now there is this empty space between the hands that wasn't there before. The liberation of the hands is partly marked or recognized by the absence of clinging, absence of grasping, and something which is an absence, the space between them. When a mind becomes liberated, it no longer has any grasping, any clinging, any contraction to anything. And how is a mind known if it's not clinging to anything? It's not like a fist, a hand, which physically you can see, the sign of a hand released is if the fist is open. Can you see that in your mind? Is the mind like just a thing, like an open hand you can see? Oh, look, there's definitely a thing there. There's a thing in the mind. that was clinging and now it's there, but it's not. I don't think it works that way. What we become aware of in the absence of clinging, liberation, freedom, is that absence, the spaciousness. To look for a liberated mind, you won't see it. You see this expanse, empty expansiveness there. And that's what the Buddha said. He said when someone becomes totally liberated, there's these certain beings like gods and Mara and devilish characters who can apparently read people's minds. When someone's fully liberated, their minds can't be read. Are they mindless? Probably not. But what's characterized as the liberated mind is this space, this absence, this something that's not there. Does that mean that they're a blank? Does that mean that they no longer have a mind? No. But to look for the mind, you won't see it. It's like most of you have a lot of memories in your mind. You know, I could probably say, you know, what happened to you when you were, you know, I don't know what, last year of high school. I don't know, maybe it was bad news to bring up, but, you know, and you probably didn't think about the last year of high school all day until I brought it up. But where was all those memories living? If you went to look for the place where they resided, where they were kept, you won't see anything. They're not kept in any visible place. You know, so they're there, but they're not in the visible sphere of the mind. So it's possible you'll go home today, and on the way there you'll run into someone who's maybe has a flat tire or something, and you seem like clearly that they're in trouble. And so you, with your generosity, you stop to help them out. Maybe you change their tire for them in the rain because you have a good rain jacket, something. So you were generous and caring for that person. But you didn't know that what you were going to be that way. Can you turn around and look at your mind sitting quietly, peacefully, and find that generosity? Does it live there, kind of like waving a flag? You might have the idea that you can be generous, but that movement of generosity is there. It's not in the visible sphere. There's something about this, I don't want to say invisible, this empty sphere of the mind. When the mind is not seen, but it still can operate. So what is it that a person who's not liberated, what do they see when they see their mind? One idea is what you see in your mind, if it's not particular things operating, like generosity or remembering or the ideas you have, but the mind itself, what people will see or feel is the holding of the mind, the clinging of the mind, the grasping of the mind. The grasping of the mind is what gives the mind shape, gives it a sense. And so people who grasp a lot, are really caught up, preoccupied, will often say their mind got really small, narrow, got really involved in something, and your forehead gets tight, and you feel constricted somehow. And the mind can feel like it gets really small, like the sphere of it, the range of it, just caught up in its preoccupation. And then something might happen, like you might suddenly be asked to go outside because, look, there's a beautiful rainbow. And you go outside, and it's looking at that rainbow, something opens up in the mind. And now the mind feels more expansive. But that, and then maybe only then do you realize how contracted it was. But that contracted sense is there because we were contracted, because we were clinging to something, holding on to something. And so often the ordinary mind, as we get mindful of it, as we get mindful of it more and more, we'll start feeling, seeing, feeling, sensing something. The quality of the mind, the shape of the mind, the character of the mind, the location of the mind. Oddly enough, if your mind has a location, if you can you turn around, look at your mind, and it seems to have a location, in the United States, a common location for the mind is in the brain. That seems like, of course, that's where the gray matter is. Isn't that where all the mental stuff goes on? If you ask Burmese where their mind is, they point to their heart. If you ask someone who is really deep in practice and free where the mind is, one of the answers they might give is they don't point to anything. They just spread their arms really wide. They want to, there's no location. The idea of a location for the mind is a kind of grasping, a clinging. It's very subtle. And, and relatively innocent to do. It's not like, maybe so much suffering involved. But when the mind gets really quiet and still, even the sense of a location can feel like a contraction. And so as people practice and get still enough to no longer be preoccupied with their thoughts, preoccupied with their feelings, their body sensations, their emotions, no longer caught up in the objects of what we can be aware of, then we start becoming aware of the quality or the state of the mind. So that's important to repeat. Ordinarily, when people go through the world, and mostly when we're awake, we are aware. And we're aware of many different things. But I think for the most part, ordinary people going around their busy, preoccupied lives, they're focusing on what they're aware of. And so involved in what they're aware of, they're not aware of themselves being aware. So I might be really concerned with almost anything, but I might be really concerned about where am I going to get dinner tonight? There's going to be any dinner for me, any food, how do I find it? It's raining, how do I get about? How do I deal with dinner? And dinner is just maybe a survival thing. So I'm just thinking dinner thoughts, and I'm so involved in the dinner thoughts that I'm not thinking at all, here I am sitting here being mindful, and there's a lot of thoughts coming up, dinner thoughts, and I can be aware of my mind knowing it, and my mind is kind of spacious and open, and I can see these thoughts bubble up, and they float through. I'm not like that. I'm just like, dinner, I gotta get dinner, and where's I going to get it? And so this idea of, we're in concern with what's happening. Part of the movement of mindfulness meditation is to begin to quiet the mind, feel safe, feel satisfied, contented enough to feel the suffering of being preoccupied, and learn how not to be so directed with the attention, always about something, getting something. One of the things we can be preoccupied by is our physical discomfort in meditation. It's nice for that to change as we meditate and model settle in. But one of the things happens with people as they develop meditation is that within reason, they're not so concerned about how uncomfortable the body is. That's not a big attraction. It's not like a major show. Oh, my knees hurt. Okay, I'll go back to my breathing. Whereas when people are new, my knees hurt and they're going to have to amputate. I better do something. This is terrible. I'm going to be, And I had this little speck on my shoulder when I was in Burma. A teeny little speck. I think it's still there. I'd never seen it before. I'd been sitting, meditating for 4 months. My mind was a little bit, if it got preoccupied by something, it was like zoned in. And I said, oh no, I'm getting cancer. So I asked if I could see a doctor. The doctor came to see me, and I showed it to him. He looked at me like look of feeling sorry for me and exasperated. There was nothing. But somehow my mind was fixated on that thing. So I hope that gives you an idea that we often get, we're concerned with what we know, not the knowing itself. As the practice settles in and we're not so driven by our clingings, our desires, our fears, our safeties, our sense of self, our conceit, all these things that kind of drive ordinary human life, those quiet down. And then because of that, there's not so much fuel to be fixated on the objects of attention, to be preoccupied by them, and we start becoming aware of the mind itself, the state of the mind, the state, whatever the mind is, start becoming aware of the quality of the mind. And the quality of the mind starts being seen in different ways. It's contracted, it's scattered, it's fragmented, it's tired, it's dull, it's bright, it's sharp, it's expansive, it's open. Buddha talked about an unrestricted mind versus a restricted mind. And we start seeing the quality of the mind, the state of the mind. And in fact, that's the instructions in mindfulness practice. At some point in practice, to start being mindful of the state of mind. And some of the descriptions of the state of mind is to recognize whether it's an expansive mind or a non-expansive mind. To know whether it's a concentrated mind or an unconcentrated mind. To know whether it's a liberated mind or an unliberated mind. So these things can be known, but they can't be known if we're kind of so concerned about what's for dinner. You know, or do they like me? Or what am I going to have for vacation next year? You know, not just next year, but what am I going to have for the next vacations for the next 10 years? You sit in meditation, going through the list. You know, you're so involved, then you're not going to notice the quality, the state of the mind. It takes a certain kind of sense of safety, openness, relaxation, ease, letting go, to start noticing the mind. And that process of letting go starts also then releases the mind from its shape, from its contraction, from its narrowness, from its location even. And the mind then becomes more clear, more luminous, more expansive, more bright, more clean, more malleable, more softer, more wieldy. They also talked about the mind becoming imperturbable. Isn't that a nice big word? An imperturbable mind. To say that in ordinary English, an unbothered mind. Wouldn't that be nice to have a mind that doesn't get bothered by anything? I think it's one of the great advices I was given in meditation was when I was told, when you meditate, don't be bothered by your thoughts. Oh, that was an interesting idea, because I was being bothered, you know. I was like, I have to stop this, I'm a problem, it shouldn't be, I should be still. Don't be bothered by them. And actually not being bothered by them made it a lot easier to settle my thinking mind. Because it wasn't really, when I was bothered by thoughts, I was bothering my thinking, steering it up. So to an unbothered mind, imperturbable mind, an equanimous mind, there's all this potential the mind has. And so the mind is not a thing. In a sense, it's a, you know, it's the sum total of you know, what's going on in the mind. But all that is just a lot of processes. We have all these mental processes, and those processes can be changed. And Buddhist practice is a practice of training the mind, developing the mind, cultivating the mind, so that it becomes calmer, more focused, more compassionate, more equanimous, more joyous, more happy, more tranquil. There's all these, it's all these wonderful words in Buddhism for a good mind. And there's a whole long list of things that are joyful in Buddhist practice. Lots of joy and happiness that goes on. Joyful mind. Now, all these good potentials the mind has that can grow in practice, what do you think happens to the mind when you cling to any of those? The mind gets contracted, it gets tight. The more tight and contracted it gets, the less joy and clarity and brightness there can be. So after a while you get a sense that clinging to any of the goodness of the mind is harmful for that goodness. And so just let go, let go, let go. One of the ways to kind of darken the mind, the light of the mind, is to have conceit around what's happening. Look at me. I bet I have the brightest, cleanest, hottest mind on the planet. Things have gotten tight again. Darkened up. And so to feel that movement and the effect supports us to keep letting go, keep opening. And some people don't appreciate, because when they look into what's left, there's nothing there. What good is that? You have a practice that leaves you with nothing. The mind becomes nothing. But it's not really nothing. It's just that the visible mind, what we see, isn't defined by anything. So the healthy functioning of the mind still operates. There's still intelligence, there's compassion, there's joy, there's wisdom, there's all this stuff can operate. And it operates a lot better when there's no contraction, when there's no clinging to anything. And so so to trust this empty mind, the expansive mind, it is not an empty mind in the sense of being... I've had an empty mind. I had a wheat allergy when I was in my 20s. I didn't know it. And so I'd feel bad. And I wanted to comfort myself. I worked at a bakery. So I wanted to comfort myself. So baguettes are a comfort food for me. So I'd eat baguettes because I had unlimited access to it. And I'd feel worse. But I didn't make the connection. So then I'd feel worse, so then I would want to, I'd eat more of the comfort food. And I'd feel worse. And so I remember one day walking through San Francisco, and it wasn't this beautiful, luminous, clear, empty mind. It was a blank mind. My mind just was not working. I thought, they have to institutionalize me. It was like there was nothing, you know, it was really a kind of a dark moment, but it's just complete this shutdown. But the luminous mind of liberation is not shut down. It's actually vibrant and full and capable to participate. So with that, as a background, I'll tell you a Zen story. And maybe now you'll appreciate the story more than be horrified. And I think of it as a myth. So there was Bodhidharma, was the Zen teacher who is said to have brought Zen to China from India. And there's a story of him showing up at the capital, at the emperor, where the emperor had an audience with the emperor. And the emperor is saying, what's the highest, most holy, sacred thing? And he'd built a lot of Buddhist temples, so he thought he was going to be praised for all the temples he'd built. And Bodhidharma said to him, nothing's holy, nothing holy. Well, that didn't go over well with the king, with the emperor. So then Bodhidharma left, and they said he found a cave in the mountains, and he meditated there for 9 years. During those 9 years, the person who became his successor came looking for him and was a monk who was been practicing for many years and hadn't had much luck with his practice and felt kind of distressed, and this new person was in town, so he went and he stood there in the winter time and outside the cave, but he couldn't get Bodhidharma's attention. Apparently he stood there for many days. And then in order to show his sincerity, that he was really serious about all, he cut off his arm and brought it to Bodhidharma. So that's, if you're pretty, it must have been pretty important for him. So that got Bodhidharma's attention. And Buddha said, what's up? What do you want from me? And he said, I'm really distressed and I'm looking for a peaceful mind. And Bodhidharma said to him, okay, bring me your mind. And then he was liberated. What would you bring if someone said, bring me your mind? You turn in and look for it. Do you find anything that you can actually come and, you know, put in the bowl here, in the bell? So probably the monk had been practicing for a long time. He probably had let go of a lot of things already. And so when he looked into the mind, he didn't see anything. And there was something about not seeing anything that allowed him to let go in the deepest way. So the citta, this mind, one of the things that I think about it, I think of it as a potential. The mind exists in us as a potential. It's not a thing. It's not the essence of who we are. But it is kind of the good news of Buddhism. The good news that this mind that we have can be developed. There's a potential to develop and become really a mind that you feel happy to live in, happy to have along. It just feels like a great companion, because rather than being your enemy or your nemesis or the mind that's challenging for you or bothering you a lot, it becomes really, it has a potential of really becoming something that's your best friend. It can be developed, and the sense of potential and growth. And some of that development is actually actively developing things like concentration and loving kindness and generosity and all kinds of good qualities of mind that actually developed and grow that support all this whole process. And some of it has to do with letting go. And letting go of all this stuff that gets in the way, all this stuff that limits the mind, until the mind becomes unrestricted. The unrestricted mind. And then the mind becomes liberated, not you. And by the time that happens, you don't mind. But you're not you. Maybe it's a relief that it's not you. Just the mind liberated. So the citta, the mind, very interesting thing that we have, don't have, can't find. It's there, it's our support. So I hope that this talk maybe was a little bit provocative for you to kind of take a, turn your attention around 180 degrees and what do you see? Is your mind. So thank you very much for this.